early in 2019, the High Court will consider a very pressing issue, Brexit. Specifically, what it means for the European Medicines Agency's £13 million a year lease of premises at Canary Wharf. Now, here we are in the middle of December 2018, and it's still next to impossible to predict anything at all about Brexit. Yet that is what we have invited Alison Hardy, partner at Ashurst, here to do. We're looking at Canary Wharf T1 Limited and others, the European Medicines Agency. And this is really the first major case, the first major property case that has Brexit at its heart, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It is our first property-related Brexit case. We are, in fact, recording this podcast on the very day that Parliament was meant to be voting on the proposed withdrawal agreement. That vote, of course, has now finally been delayed at the last minute. And in addition, only yesterday, the European Court of Justice ruled that the UK could unilaterally withdraw the Article 50 notice if Parliament approves that decision. All this against the Attorney General's advice that the protocol could endure indefinitely unless and until a further agreement supersedes it. It couldn't be more prescient in terms of exciting times, Brexit and property related.
It certainly couldn't. Now, this particular case focuses on a discrete issue relating to Brexit. So can you remind us what the problem is at the heart of this case?
Sure. There's a bunch of dates that I'll take you through now. So June 2016, UK obviously, as we all know, narrowly voted to leave the EU. Mm-hmm. 5 years before that, in 2011, the European Medicines Agency signed an agreement for lease to take a 25-year lease of 10 floors in Churchill Place in Canary Wharf without any break right. The lease was completed 3 years later in 2014. Brussels insists that a non-member state cannot host EU agencies. And so in November 2017, the EMA announced that it would relocate from London to Amsterdam following that 2016 referendum result. Interestingly, the European Banking Agency is also moving, although they're going to Paris. But they are not involved in this case, as the European Banking Agency does have a break right, allowing it to leave their lease at the end of 2020, albeit they'll have to pay a penalty of about €3 million.
Illustrates the importance of making sure you've got a break right in your lease.
Yes, exactly, and perhaps making sure that the left hand's talking to the right hand. According to a European Parliament report, the EMA will have to pay a rent of €16 million a year plus taxes and charges until 2039. The total bill is estimated at €400 million, which interestingly the EU is suggesting the UK government should pay. It seems that when the EMA entered into this lease, they didn't give any thought to whether they could assign, sublet or terminate their lease before announcing the competition to relocate the EMA within a member state and finally announcing that it would relocate to Amsterdam. Many asset managers listening will be very familiar with the concept of people making decisions and thinking about property later on. I think it's safe to assume that the EMA did try to get out of their lease. They clearly were unsuccessful because in June 2018, Canary Wharf issued a claim in the High Court for a declaration that the withdrawal from the UK of the UK from the EU and the relocation of the EMA does not frustrate the EMA's lease.
Okay, so let's take a step back from this case for a second. So can you explain the principle of frustration?
Yeah, frustration's a rarely used argument in property cases. In fact, it's rarely used at all, and that's for good reason. In essence, the courts can order that a contract, or in this case a lease, is frustrated when something happens after completion which makes it impossible to fulfil the contract or impossible for the party's obligation to be performed because it's been radically transformed. This is ancient law, dating back to 1863, and the courts have been reluctant to discharge contracts on the basis of frustration, because, as we know from a number of cases like Arnold and Britain recently, they don't want to allow parties to escape from what later seems to them to be a bad bargain.
Mm. So can you offer us some examples of where frustration has been successfully argued previously?
Yeah, the cases here are really ancient again. So the leading case, 1869, Bailey and de Crisny, a tenant covenanted that neither he nor his assigns would build on a piece of land. And then his land was compulsory acquired by a railway company, who then built a station using their statutory powers. And the court held that the original covenanting tenant wasn't liable. He was compelled to sell his piece of land. He couldn't choose his assignee. He couldn't bind the railway company to comply with the covenant. And so he was released from his obligation. In addition, changes in law have been held to frustrate contracts of service. So in 1948, a solicitor's retainer agreement with a gas company was held to be frustrated by the nationalisation, which was affected by the Gas Act. Wartime restrictions are frequently held to frustrate contracts, and changes of law that make performance of a contract illegal. But it's never been ordered in the case of a lease. The closest we've come to a lease being frustrated related to the coronation of King Edward VII. So the case here is Krell and Henry in 1903. And the defendant agreed in writing to hire some rooms in a flat in Pall Mall in order to see the coronation of King Edward VII. The written contract made no reference to the processions, but it was clear from the circumstances that both parties regarded the viewing of the processions as the sole purpose for the hiring. And then the king contracted appendicitis, and the processions were postponed, and the defendant declined to pay the cost of the hire. And the Court of Appeal held that the contract was frustrated. In fact, there were several cases, all relating to the postponement of the procession, where the courts held that the contracts had been frustrated. So the question here is Brexit akin to the king contracting appendicitis?
Well, I don't know about you, but certainly starting to feel a bit like appendicitis for me. Yeah. And I suspect the same might be true of Theresa May. Now, you mentioned that it is the landlord that is the one that has taken this to court, seeking a declaration, in effect, that Brexit wouldn't frustrate the lease. What do you anticipate will be the key arguments it will be employing at trial?
In practice, arguing that an unforeseen event is sufficient to frustrate a contract can be incredibly difficult. It depends largely on the judge's discretion. Canary Wharf's argument is likely to be that because the EU withdrawal from the EU is provided for in EU legislation under Article 50, it was always a possibility. Mm. It wasn't unforeseeable. Of course, the debate on the desirability of membership of the EU within the UK has been going on for quite some time. It's not exactly a surprise. And in the lead up to the 2015 general election, David Cameron promised a referendum on membership of the EU. Now, some might say that because this lease was entered into in October 2014, mm-hmm. The 2015 general election was the relevant date, but actually it was subject to an agreement for lease from 2011. But when you look back at the Conservative manifesto from 2010, it also promised that there would be a referendum on any future transfer of powers or competences to the EU. And this question about what did the parties anticipate when they entered into these obligations, it's why the judge has allowed each party to call an expert, very unusually in the field of modern British political history and political science, to give evidence as to what the parties could have expected at the time they entered into the agreement for lease and lease. Canary Wharf will no doubt argue that if the EMA had wanted to be able to exit in these circumstances, they could have negotiated for a break, and they didn't.
So it sounds like there could be some interesting days of evidence when the case does come to trial.
Exactly.
Cross-examining of modern British political historians. So in turn, what will the EMA be looking for from these proceedings, and what arguments is it relying on?
So the EMA is arguing that the UK's exit from the EU will amount to an event of frustration in relation to their lease. And also they're arguing that it would amount to an event that would render the EMA's future performance of the lease ultra vires and so unenforceable as a matter of EU law. They say that from Brexit Day, the rights and obligations of the parties to the lease will be of no effect and cease to bind the parties.
And what are some of the other key questions that the court will have to grapple with?
Some of the things that the court's going to have to think about here are not just the extraneous questions, is this a frustrating event or isn't it? Mm. But even if it is a frustrating event, what is a frustrating event? So is it the referendum? Is it the service of the withdrawal notice? Is it whatever day that Parliament happens to vote on the deal? Is it exit day itself? What impact does the ECJ's announcement that we can unilaterally withdraw have? So if, for example, the service of the withdrawal notice is deemed to be the frustrating event. But then later the ECJ says we had always had the power to withdraw that. What impact does that have? What if there's a people's vote? There are so many issues here that the court's going to grapple with, and it's going to be a really interesting judgment which will have wide sweeping effect far beyond property.
As with all of Brexit, lots of unanswered questions. But there can't be many organisations in exactly the same position as the EMA. The spectrum of tenants who may argue that their business is adversely affected by Brexit must be fairly wide. So how widespread do you think the ramifications of this case can get?
It could be huge, and I'm not overstating it. So if this decision goes against Canary Wharf, then it's not just European agencies, as you say. It could go right beyond the property market into any contractual obligation that parties enter into. So take, for example, banks. If they lose their passporting rights, then they'll lose a significant proportion of the business that they conduct with the EU. Can they get out of their leases? Can they get out of their other contractual obligations? What about courier companies who spend a huge amount of time delivering parcels across Europe? Can they get out of all of their contractual obligations? And it goes far beyond that. I can really see this causing a massive crisis in the economy if it goes in the EMA's direction at judgment.
Yeah, sounds like it could have huge effects, and not least on the legal textbook writers who may have to update their chapters on frustration for the first time in a century.
So true.
Would you say that if the EMA doesn't succeed on this argument, if they don't persuade the court that Brexit could constitute an event of frustration in its lease, that it would then be highly unlikely that any other tenant would be able to succeed with a similar argument?
My first instinct was that if Canary Wharf win, it'll shut down this line of argument completely. But I think it all depends on what comes out of the judgment. Mm. So if the judgment all turns on foreseeability, then it will depend on what were the circumstances at the time that the parties entered into an agreement, what they anticipated, and whether they could have anticipated Brexit at the time. And so I think it all depends on what the judgment says. So foreseeability will give you questions about when did you enter into the agreement, what did you know? And if the judgment says no, frustration isn't available in the event of you having a lease, then that won't prevent people claiming frustration on the basis of Brexit for other contracts. Mm. So I think it will really depend. My instinct is this will go in Canary Wharf's direction, Canary Wharf will win, and that the courts will try and shut down further argument, but they might not.
It sounds like you generally think that Canary Wharf is going to win, but do you think we'll see a judgment before we're scheduled to leave the EU as things stand?
Yes, the initial direction set the case to be heard before the 29th of March. They expedited this trial because of the importance of it for the public and for the certainty for the economy. The trial's actually listed for mid-January, ironically after this week's developments, perhaps the same time as the meaningful vote gets delayed until. I think a judge will want to give judgment as soon as they can to limit uncertainty. So I think a judgment will be given before March 29th. And I think, as I say, Canary Wharf will win and the EMA will be bound by their lease.
I imagine the judge, whoever it is that will be hearing this case, he or she will probably want to know as much as possible about what shape Brexit will take before they take the decision, because really you don't know the implications of events on the EMA's lease until you know what shape it takes. It must be very difficult.
It must be incredibly difficult. I'm glad I'm not the judge.
So there are a huge number of variables involved, not least, as you say, whether Brexit does even happen. But assuming that and assuming the case proceeds, do you think it's more likely that the EMA could find favour in the higher courts, perhaps even the Supreme Court?
I think if the EMA do lose at first instance, they might well seek leave to appeal. You have to remember, of course, this isn't their case.
Yes.
They're the defendant in it. And I don't know how enthusiastic they are, although I'm sure Jonathan Zietler is being very enthusiastic about defending the case. But I think they might seek leave to appeal if they lose. And in those circumstances, we might see it going up to the High Courts, initially the Court of Appeal, unless they get permission to leapfrog up to the Supreme Court. it is possible that a higher court would extend the scope of frustration. Mm-hmm. So they might get more sympathy there. But given the economic ramifications, if the EMA succeed, and given the court's historic reluctance to extend frustration, I'd be very surprised if they succeed. But then I've been surprised by the Supreme Court only last week.
In the Francis case, I assume you mean.
Indeed.
So let's open this up a little bit more generally. The EMA will be the first big Brexit property case, as we said, but do you foresee more Brexit-related litigation in the months and years to come? And what do you think will be some of the major battlegrounds?
I mean, as we record this, here we are in December 2018, I think it's impossible to know what's going to happen next year. It's hard to know what's going to happen next week. Whilst that's always true, it's hard to predict the future in December, I think it's very much more true this year. The Brexit referendum has definitely had an impact on the commercial real estate market. Notably, some transactions are being delayed. Other transactions have fallen away. Some funds are scaling back their investments. Money markets have definitely seen volatility. However, the UK remains one of the most liquid and transparent markets in the world. It's stable and secure democratic government, independent judiciary, open companies and land registries. It makes it very attractive for foreign investors, particularly in relation to commercial real estate, which for many years has been seen as a safe haven. And that asset is something that people often want to use to preserve wealth and escape debt crises and political drama elsewhere. And whilst we've got our own political dramas ongoing at the moment, the judiciary remains independent and respected, and the choice of English law to govern contractual disputes is really popular. Obviously, the weaker pound is going to make it more attractive for foreign investors to continue to invest in the UK, and people are looking to acquire property at a discount. In terms of property disputes, I think unless we avoid Brexit entirely, I think we can expect to see more break options being exercised in 2019. I think we can perhaps expect to see more cases where landlords challenge the validity of breaks, trying to keep their tenants on the hook. I think we can see more attempts to get out of contractual obligations, which no longer look attractive in light of Brexit, whatever Brexit finally looks like. And question you and I were discussing only the other day, will 2018's year of the CVA carry on next year? Probably, I think. I think it's unlikely the government's going to have the time or the will to change the law around CVAs. So I think CVAs will roll on in 2019 and perhaps there'll be much more insolvency if Brexit does hit.
I'm sure there will. I'm sure you're right. And as ever, we'll be keeping abreast of all of these issues and developments at EG. Thanks for coming in, Alison. And perhaps we'll speak again when judgment is ultimately given, if not before.
Very welcome.